welcome to the Jukebox Podcast from WP Tavern. My name is Nathan Wrigley. Jukebox is a podcast which is dedicated to all things WordPress. The people, the events, the plugins, the blocks, the themes, and in this case, the importance of typography for your websites. If you'd like to subscribe to the podcast, you can do that by searching for WP Tavern in your podcast player of choice, or by going to wptavern.com/feed/podcast, and you can copy that URL into most podcast players. If you have a topic that you'd like us to feature on the podcast, I'm keen to hear from you, and hopefully get you or your idea featured on the show. Head to wptavern.com/contact/jukebox and use the form there. So on the podcast today, we have Julia Larko. Julia is a web designer and developer who has been working on the web since the mid-1990s. Her primary interests are web typography and font design. In addition to project development, she's a consultant and a trainer, mostly working with CSS, web fonts, and web typography. This is the last of our podcasts from WordCamp Europe 2023. I spoke to Julia in Athens because she had just finished her presentation entitled Typographic Readability in Theme Design and Development. In this session, she explored how designers can assist with the readability of websites through careful consideration of the fonts they choose and why they choose them. It turns out there's quite a lot to consider, and if you've not given this topic much thought in the past, you'll perhaps learn something new. I certainly did. We begin the podcast talking through how, at the start of the web, we were making do with a limited range of tools to help us make typographic choices. There were no web fonts available, but that started to change around 2010. Now we have access to hundreds of fonts and need to be mindful that some fonts can pose readability challenges for some users of your website. Julia talks about the fact that the manner in which we read has changed since the dawn of the internet. Many people now mostly consume small passages of text, which need to be considered in a different way to longer writing. Concentrating upon the letters in the Latin alphabet, we talk about the ways in which readers typically break up words into smaller units, and the fact that the way letters are shaped can make them easier to parse. There's some technical language here, ligatures, X-height, apertures, and more, which tell us about the shaping and spacing of letters. Julia explains the current state of research into how these characteristics of fonts can affect readability. We talk about whether or not there are fonts which are more readable than others. Is there a collection of fonts which you can use and be confident that you're going to make it easy for all users of your websites? Julia talks about how designs need to consider the spaces into which the text is put. Most people have a proclivity for the order in which they view a page, and knowing about this path across the page can help your readers access the text. The width of the text is also important. You want people to be able to read from side to side without having to move their head. How does this work across different device sizes? And what can be said about text which runs right to left or top to bottom? We round off the conversation with Julia telling us where we can find out more, as well as some of the thought leaders in this space. It's a fascinating conversation about a subject that often gets overlooked. Web designers, this episode is for you. If you're interested in finding out more, you can find all of the links in the show notes by heading to wptavern.com/podcast, where you'll find all the other episodes as well. And so, without further delay, I bring you Julia Larko. I am joined on the podcast by Julia Larko. Hello, Julia.
Hello.
It's very nice to have you on. Julia is joining me at WordCamp EU in Athens. It's the last conversation that I'm recording, so very nice to have you on. You're going to be talking to us today about something that I genuinely didn't know about. This was a really interesting topic to research from my point of view. You're going to be talking to us a little bit about typography. That's based upon a workshop that you did yesterday. How did it go?
I'm happy about that. I'm happy to hear that you are interested in typography as well.
Was it well attended? Did you get your information across? Did people engage with the topic?
I think so. I divided people in two groups, developers and designers, so to let them think about typography with the mentality of the others. So that was the point I was trying to have.
Well, the reason I wanted to talk to you was because when I was looking through the list of presentations and workshops, yours was really different, a topic that I genuinely hadn't thought about in the way that you've made me think about it. Because whenever I think about typography, I am really just thinking about whether I like a font. So if I go to a website, I just make a quick judgment. Do I like that font? Do I not like that font? But there's a lot more to it than that, which we're going to get into. But can you just tell us why you're interested in this? Do you have a history with working with type? Why are you so fascinated by typography?
Okay, well, maybe it's because I started making websites at the very beginning of the internet era. It was around mid-90s, and we didn't have the possibility to use web fonts of any kind on the web. We did what we could with very few tools. Whereas later on in 2009 or 10, we had this great possibility of using web fonts. And I started to get engaged with the typography. And that was the time when I started typography for the first time, actually.
Are you interested in typography away from the internet? Are you interested in the way that type is presented in books and on paper?
Yes, everywhere. And menus as well.
Yeah, because when you actually turn your attention to typography, which is what I did after we booked this interview, text is everywhere. And it's really, really different wherever you look. So we're sitting in a room. There's almost no text, but there's a little bit of text behind you. It has a particular font.
Montserrat,
probably, yeah. I'm looking at my computer. It has a font on it. I've just been downstairs, looked at a menu. It had three or four fonts on it. Wherever you look, there is text. And usually the typography has been thought about. But you were talking about typography from the point of view of how it can be done better, how it can be a problem for some people. And that I didn't really realize. I knew that people would perhaps struggle to read text because it was too small, or there was a background color which clashed with the color of the text, but I didn't realize that the font itself could be a problem. So tell us how it can be a problem. How can some people struggle to read one font but not another?
Well, it's a big question because there's a lot of research about that. Recent research on readability, because very few people read a lot nowadays in each country. So a lot of countries are worried about that. So there are movements to let people read better by making some tools. And big companies like Adobe, Google are on this concern, are concerned about that. So they are trying to study that subject. The Readability Consortium, a consortium from between these big companies and universities in America, and it's working interdisciplinary. So with psychologists, typographers, graphic designers, and started to focus on what makes text legible. And what they are, as far as I know, they are saying is that it's different for everybody. So you test it, and so that's why you need to make tools that help people adjust their text when they read, for long form reading, of course, and not for just a menu or very few words you are going to read. And they're trying to do those tools. And maybe it's difficult for a user to know what they need.
Right.
So they are working also with AI, trying to have some patterns and have some themes, let's say so, that can adapt to very different kind of people. But they are trying to reach that patterns by research, not by guessing. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, again, when I was researching this, it suddenly occurred to me that I have children. They're grown up largely now. But I remember when they came home from school at the beginning, their homework was in child-friendly fonts, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Often it was something along the lines of Comic Sans or something like that. And it didn't occur to me at all at the time. I just thought, oh, well, it's a child friendly font. It's kind of round and it's got, you know, there's no hard edges. I just thought it's just a pleasant thing to look at. But now that I'm thinking about it, it was probably an easier font for the child to begin to learn to read with, because all of the letters were clear. There was no confusion between one letter and the other. You know, you couldn't mistake the L for the I, for example. And I did wonder, you were saying that there's less people reading than ever. If the typography is a, quote, difficult font, it may be more difficult to begin learning to read. I don't know if that's something that you were trying to say there.
Well, actually, when a child starts reading, has a very tough task, and helping that process is important. I remember seeing books in uppercase letters only. It was meant to be simpler, but they started only to recognize only one kind of letters in the Latin alphabet. We have uppercase and lowercase, and they're very different because of their history. Uppercase letters comes from the engraved Latin letters, whereas the small lowercase comes from calligraphy. So they're very different origins. And it's not the same to learn a lowercase a and a lowercase a, recognizing them as the same letter, the same sound. And with sound, it's also difficult, especially in English. You have so much problem with sounds and letters.
Yeah, I think we have 44 sounds, but only 26 letters.
And the combination, when you use a letter and a sound, other languages are much more simpler on that respect.
Yeah, again, remarkable. I'd never really given any thought to how different uppercase and lowercase are, but they don't bear, in some cases, they're quite similar.
Yes.
So an L and a capital L, broadly the same, but something like an A, the capital letter A and the lowercase letter, they're just utterly different, aren't they?
Yes.
They're really, really remarkably different. Oh, that's fascinating. I hadn't given that any thought. So what makes text legible to a lot of people or not legible to a lot of people? Are there any kind of guidelines around that?
Okay, I will distinguish between legibility and readability, because you have this distinction in English and it's great. We don't have it in Italian. I guess the legibility comes from Latin, as we have for legibilità in Italian. And it's something that has to do with decoding. So that's something that has to do with the typeface. Whereas readability is something you want to read. You like to read something you want to read, and not you're just trying to decode things. So that's a big difference when you start to understand why a text is readable or not. I would say that trying to take a legible font means to have a font with certain characteristics. For example, it's, let's say, proved that a font with a higher X height is more legible. I'm talking about running text, the body text, for long reading experience. So X height is basically the medium height of the lowercase letters based on the letter X. That's why X height, you see. And so, for example, I don't know, Helvetica has a higher X height than Times New Roman, for example, if you compare it. And having a higher X height is a typeface be more readable. And another very important thing is with apertures. Apertures, how can I say, the white space inside the part of the letters that are open. Take a lowercase e in the lower part of the letter. You have this room. If it's more closed, it's less legible because it can be taken for an O, for example. You see? So Helvetica, for example, it's very well used, but it's not legible as a body copy. Helvetica is wonderful for display type, for titles, but not so well for body text.
So you're saying, so this X height, so is typically the height of the letter X. So if I put an X next to the letter H, for example, it's the height of the rounded bit of the letter H.
Yes, exactly.
Or it would be the height of the letter A or the rounded bit of the letter P. The more tall that bit is, the more legible it is for most people to read. I had no idea.
Well, it's just one thing, because not only that, because it's also how you set type. For example, if you have a large X height typeface and you set it with a very small space between the lines, the line height, the leading, they say in typography, you don't take advantage of that highness, you see.
Okay, so if letters are squashed, if one line of letters is compressed, so line height is compressed up against another line of letters beneath it, that makes it more difficult to read because there's just no room for the letters to breathe. There's no gap. They're all just squished together. Okay.
But you have to pay attention not to put too much line height. Otherwise, you lose the next line. When you jump from one line to the other, it's too far and you can't find it.
So this is the eye's ability to go from the end of one line and track and immediately find the beginning of
yes,
the next.
Yes, exactly.
I confess, I have experienced that problem before, and I hadn't noticed until just now that that was because of that. I've definitely had books that I've been reading where I've struggled to begin the next line and sometimes repeated the line that I was supposed to be on, or I've skipped a line and missed a line out and only halfway through thought, actually, that doesn't make any sense. Let me go back. I had no idea. But also you're saying that the amount of, what did you call it? The space?
Oh, typographers call it leading because it comes from of the metal types. With metal types, they used to put some space between the lines with some lead. So the lead bars.
Oh, okay. So they spaced them out with a physical
object. Yes, exactly.
And it was a bar of lead. And the wider the bar of lead, the more space.
Yes.
This is fascinating. But you also mentioned in the letter E, for example, the lowercase e. Forgive me if I misunderstood. So the bottom half of the letter E, there's a gap.
Yes.
A little gap. And the amount of gap, if the gap is bigger.
That's the aperture. Yes.
The bigger the gap is, the more you're likely to be able to read it typically.
Yes, because you're likely to distinguish it from an O.
Of course.
You decode it easiest.
You keep mentioning Helvetica. Is that a font which has lots of problems? Is that why you mention it? Because it's full of things that you can identify?
It's very well known. That's why I'm mentioning. And very much used. But it's better to use it as a display type.
The only thing that I've ever had a problem reading was the thing that I've just described where I have skipped a line or gone back and reread the other line. I'm imagining that you've done this talk because there are problems which people experience, which I fortunately don't appear to have a problem with. What trips people up? If you were somebody that, I don't know how to say this correctly, if you're somebody who struggles to read, what are the tripwires, if you know what I mean? What are the things in a font could be wrong that make you unable to read? So you mentioned that the line height, you mentioned the X height. Is there more to it than that?
Well, there might be a lot. One thing that I can think of are ambiguous forms of letters. Let's take lowercase letters B and Q or B and D. So for these four letters in a sans serif font, for example, are usually with the same shape, just flipped or rotated. That's said to be a problem with people that experience dyslexia, but it's actually opinionated because we don't know exactly how it works. Actually, for everybody, it can be a problem to distinguish between similar shapes. For example, as you said before, a child who is starting to read or to write as well may experience the same problem, no matter if there's a problem of dyslexia or not. So if you are going to avoid these kind of things, you can pick a font, a serif font that generally has different letters, different forms. The four letters I mentioned, typically with small serifs in different parts of the letters, so they can be distinguished for sure.
Can you, I know it's probably obvious to most people, but will you just tell people what a serif font is and what it isn't? You know, if you've got a non-serif font or a serif font, what's the difference?
Let's take an example of Helvetica and Times New Roman. So maybe it's easier for people to visualize the difference. Helvetica has straight lines, nothing at the termination of the strokes, whereas Times New Roman has some small shapes that derives from the calligraphic or the, in that case, for the uppercase, the engraving, the instrument that we use to engrave. And so they had these little tails, let's say so, that distinguish the kind of fonts. And the font has a different mood, very different mood, and a lot of other characteristics. There are, well, history of typography is based on that, more or less.
It always feels to me as if a font, a serif font, which has these, I think you use the word where the letter terminates. I've never really thought about that. They always look as if they're more, I don't know, maybe in a legal document or something like that. They have this feeling of something more powerful or more important or something. It's quirky, that, isn't it? I'm looking at a Google Doc where I've written my show notes and I don't see any of that. I can't tell you that either of those fonts, a serif font or a non-serif font, I find them both equally easy to read. It doesn't trip me up at all. But typically, is there a problem for some people with a serif font or a non-serif font? Is there one to catch everybody? Would it be better to not deploy a serif font, or is there just no difference in people's ability to cope with either?
Each font is maybe very different. Most people at the first level, when they start talking about typography, they started to see this difference. But that's not the main point. Maybe the main point in readability is the rhythm of letters. The rhythm where the white space and the black space, meaning when you have black text on white, they alternate each other. Try to figure out this word, minimum. You'll have a lot of rhythm, minimum in written in lower case letters, you see. So the rhythm is very, very different. And maybe that's important in typography, in reading. And it's very important for people who struggle with reading, because you don't interrupt the rhythm. The rhythm helps reading.
It just sort of bounces along, doesn't it? If you look at the word minimum, it genuinely has a, it's almost like a little wave pattern going up and down, isn't it?
Yes.
That's fascinating. So what did you call it? Your ability to read it. There was a word you just said. Rhythm. So words can have rhythm, and the more rhythm there is, the easier it is to read. So if a font provides rhythm, that's a good thing.
I think so. But it depends also on the purpose. Long reading, I think that's important. Otherwise, it's different. It's totally different, I mean, concepts with display types, because they have a different purpose. You know, text and function. The titles have different purpose. They have to catch the attention, whereas the body text has to be read, so needs a different kind of attention.
Right. And are there any guidelines which kind of fonts catch the attention more and which kind of fonts work better with the body content, you know, where you're reading long paragraphs and so on? Does it matter, or is there one kind of font that you would recommend in each case?
Generally, when you buy a font, you'll have a font that is meant for body text and some other for display type. So if you rely on what the designer, the type designer has done, you are safe. Otherwise, you have to try. But also, if you go on a repository like Google Fonts, for example, you have this distinction among display types and other kind of types. So it's quite a common mistake at the beginning to take display type and use it as a body text. And that's a typographic crime.
I like it. Typographic crime. That's great. We're all of us using our devices more and more. It's funny that you said that reading is becoming less and less, because it feels like we have text in front of us all the time now. So we're constantly staring at our mobile phones and our computers. But when I was a child, if I wasn't holding a book, I probably wasn't reading. I mean, maybe there was a poster somewhere or something. But I'm surprised that reading is, there's less desire to read, because it feels like every day I'm reading more or less constantly. You know, I'm scanning Twitter or Facebook or whatever.
It's a new kind of reading, because we had long form reading for books. Then we have glanceable reading for, I don't know, street signs or maybe a menu in a website. And then we have this, they call it interlude reading. You read when you have time, you don't have a lot of attention. You scroll, and then you have also that the way we read on the web is very different from what we read elsewhere. For example, we have this shape, F-shaped reading when we, in a website, eye tracking has shown it quite a lot. You start from the top left where the logo generally is, then you go on the right, then you go on the left, but a bit bottom, and then a bit, you're just drawing an F, more or less, when you read.
So that's what the eye typically does when it lands on a web page.
Yes.
What was that? Top left, top right.
Bottom.
Bottom.
A bit in the middle right, and then bottom again.
So it makes an, if you were to draw on top of that screen, it coincidentally looks a bit like a capital F.
Yes, exactly.
That's fascinating.
Capital F reading.
Capital F reading. Presumably that's on a desktop. On this, I'm not doing that, am I? I'm holding up my phone. If I'm looking at a web page, presumably it's a different experience. It's just left to right, left to right, left to right.
Also because you are hiding some part of the text with your thumbs. Are you right-handed, left-handed? It depends what you do. And it changes a lot. For example, in the UX design, we generally change some patterns with smartphones because we put some menus at the bottom because the area near the thumb, for example. So if it changes where you put your fingers, your changes also where you put your eyes, focusing in which part of the screen.
Yeah, that's interesting. My experience of the internet is that usually the menu on a mobile device comes at the top right. There's usually some icon.
But that's for convention.
But what you've just described is much more sensible, having the menu at the bottom, because
I hope it will change soon.
Because my thumb can just go right to it. It's just there. Yeah, that's fascinating. It does matter what device you're on. But are you using the same, I know that you've said that you reposition things like the menu or what have you, but are you using the same font on a desktop as you would be on a mobile device? Is it broadly the same? You don't need to worry about the viewport of a mobile device in terms of the CSS for setting the font. It's just the same desktop, mobile, tablet, same fonts.
From the readability point of view, I would say yes. And it's for branding. I guess it's better to have different environments recognizable. Whereas you have to pay attention to licensing. If you buy a font, for example, you put it on an app, you might need a different license. If you're using open source fonts, you are not going to have a problem. But if you rent web fonts, yeah, you might have some problems, or you have to check if you can put that web font on an app. You might need a different license.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. It's always quite common in the circle of friends that I have. Comic Sans is a font which most of my friends ridicule. They think it's a childish font. Nobody would put it on a professional website. Are there some fonts like that which you would just always avoid? Not because they look childish, but because they are largely unreadable.
There might be some. For example, well, Comic Sans has a very big history of love and hate, basically of hate, actually. But remember the case and presentation of the Higgs boson?
Yes. Was that done in Comic Sans?
Yes. There was a Twitter storm. Okay, you couldn't use that informal font on a formal presentation. And that raised the topic, actually. You have to use the font that is proper to the situation. It's like clothing. The clothes you wear, it's like the font you use. It depends on the situation. But I can understand the feeling that people have when they choose Comic Sans. And maybe I can suggest something similar, but a bit more proper or a bit more interesting in that context. There's one font I'm on Google Fonts repository that's called Emantic Small Caps. And it's a small cap, so it's not lowercase. But it has a similar mood. And I would dare, it's quite a new Comic Sans in the mood. I mean, it has the same mood, in my opinion. I say in my opinion, it's also because it's in my culture. It's very culture dependent because it's based on what you saw, what you associate to those fonts, for example.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When I travel to the US, the US have a really different set of fonts which they use, especially on government documents, than we have in the UK. And wherever I look, so I don't know, I buy some sun cream or something like that, the font choice is utterly different from how it would typically look in the UK. And it's kind of curious that it's so obvious to me that that's an American box. And yet it's merely a font that tells me that, but I can see it all the time. But what you're saying though is you've got to use your intuition. There's no rule for this is a good font, that's a bad font. It's really, where are you putting it? and your own personal preference. There are no fonts which are out of the question because they're just literally unreadable by a subset of the people. No, you look like you're about to say something.
Well, there might be some fonts that are really unlegible, but there are some really nice experiments by very talented type designers, David Jonathan Ross. He tried to push the boundaries of readability, making good fonts, but making how long you can go to draw a very new kind of letter and still have it readable. So that's interesting to see, but made by people who know what they do. Whereas if you look at fonts that you can have on a lot of websites, just experiments by people who start. But if you look at experiments by very good designers, you know what they do.
You make client websites still. Do you get into this conversation quite a lot with your clients? Is typography something that you bang the drum of?
I try to listen, as for everything else, to the client and understand what they need. And then I try to suggest what I think is proper. It's like also for the color of a website, for example. I ask and I give an advice, maybe.
Are there any kind of hard and fast rules for where you really, it would be unwise to put typography? In our show notes, I was talking about things like, is it a bad idea to put, fonts into images? So you're overlaying fonts on images. In other words, is it better always to have fonts on a plain background rather than on, let's say you've got a mountain scene or something and you want to write something, you put it onto the image. Is it better to keep the text away from the images? That was just one thought.
That's definitely better, but you have to distinguish between titles and body copy. A title might be, it would be okay anyway. It's only a word. You might have some tricks, for example, reducing the contrast of the underground image. As long as you stick with accessibility guidelines, you're safe for that regard. They're a very good starting point for readability. I generally say that it's better to start from accessibility, and there are a lot of accessibility guidelines that help with the text. And then you go on, and if you have some tools like a very powerful web font, you can do more. And then you go with typesetting and start typesetting well. For example, you have to top the line length. That's very, very important. You don't have to let your user go through all the screen, a very huge screen, to go to the other line, to the second line.
Is there any guidance about how wide the text line should be? So maybe that's you said using a number of pixels is not always the best idea, but is there a character limit or a word limit typically where the eye can cope with scanning from left to right and then beginning again? Because I'm staring at a Google Doc at the moment, and it's kind of interesting that the Google Doc looks like a piece of paper, and they've obviously deliberately taken it in. The Google Doc could consume the whole width of my monitor, but it doesn't. They've confined it to what looks like a piece of paper, and I presume that's a convention just so that my eye doesn't have to go far left, far right, far left, far right. I could keep my nose pointed at the document and just let my eye do the work, whereas if it went from left to right, I would be moving my neck all the time as well. So is there a guidance of how wide text should be?
Typographers for a long time had recommended a line length of between 45 and 65 characters per line. It depends for Latin alphabets. The web accessibility guidelines says, I think at the level AAA, they say that they need 80 characters maximum per line for Latin. I think 40 for languages with ideograms. So they say something about that. And it's very interesting to see that there's a correlation between this line length and the way we read. The way we read is basically with eye and brain, because it's a really complex process. But when we read with the eye, we just focus on few letters at a time, maybe 6-7 characters. Then we jump to another area of fixation. And so you can do some math. A very good typographer, Bruno Mag, made that math. And he discovered that calculating the number of characters you see in each fixation has a relationship with what typographers said for years, for decades, for centuries, actually. So they arrived at the same conclusions. So let's say 55, 65 characters per line, a good measure.
Yeah.
On the other hand, all these factors are correlated, and especially font size, line height, and line length. Some typographer says that it's like a triangle of these three elements have to be on balance. So if you change one, you have to change the others, adapt the others.
So we've just been talking about the left to rightness, the line length. Is there anything about the length of the paragraphs that you use as well? I mean, I'm just used to reading books, and obviously they're confined by the width. The line length is taken account of, but I'm conscious that everything's broken up into paragraphs, and those chunks of meaning have often got little gaps between them. I'm imagining in many cases, paragraphs could go on for pages, but it's better to break it up, and it helps the brain to associate that this is a body of meaning and here's another body of meaning and so on.
Yes, I think absolutely the basic of our work as web designers, actually. So it's different from what we do on paper, because on screens, we have to catch the attentions. And so we need to make things very easy for the reader. That's the purpose. Maybe it's not always the case that that's the purpose, but on web design, generally, that's the purpose. So it's better to split a paragraph in a few small chunks, let's say so, and give different styling and introduce hierarchy as well. So that helps a lot in reading.
So headings and paragraphs and other headings and so on. You mentioned in the show notes that when you did your workshop, you were going to give some helpful CSS to break up the text. Can you just tell us what that was? What helpful CSS did you have?
Basically, I would say that it's very important not to use an absolute unit when you set the font size. Well, font size is what is more relevant in readability, because if it's too small, you can't read at all. If it's too big, also you can't read it well. So font size is very important. And after the responsive web design, we've had the responsive web typography. It didn't come at the same time, because with responsive web design, we started to make things different for different devices, but we didn't touch the font size.
Right. It was just the same. Yeah.
But it was really important to change the font size. At the beginning, I thought that it was important to make smaller font size on smartphones because you had a very smaller screen. But that was not the reason, I realized later on. And the reason is the distance of reading. So when you read something that is near, you don't need a big font size. You generally keep an iPhone at 20, 30 centimeters of distance from your eye. Whereas if you read to a computer, you are 70 centimeters, 80, 1 meter, I don't know. If you read to a screen in a room, for example, it's very, very different. For example, yesterday I had this at the workshop. I had this CSS code pen. I realized I had some minimum and maximum font size in my slider. It was perfect for desktop reading. As soon as I was in the room, I said, oh no, I have to change. And I changed it to different values because of that.
So the presentation looked good on your computer, but as soon as it went on the big screen.
Okay, the presentation was okay because I knew it in advance. I mean, it was a presentation, but it was in the playground, I realized. Yes. And because I had all those values, I was guessing what was reasonable values, but I didn't test it before on such a big room.
So I'm guessing that at some point soon, we'll be able to make a link to WordPress TV. It occurs to me that the whole time we've been talking about typography, but we've probably been concentrating on English. Although it's a common language, it's by no means what everybody reads. So we're going from top to bottom, left to right, but other parts of the world, let's say people that read Arabic or Hebrew or Korean or Japanese or Chinese, whatever it is, they're going in completely different directions, left to right, bottom to top, and so on. Do they have similar concerns with their characters? Or is it just uniquely the Latin set of characters which has these problems?
I'm sure they have also maybe different problems. I'll distinguish between Arabic to the other languages you mentioned, like Japanese, Chinese, and Korean, for example. They have ideograms. with Arabic, it's quite the calligraphic origin of the way of writing. And they make a lot of use of ligatures. It means it changes the shape of letters according to their combination. We have ligatures in Latin as well. For example, if you think of F and I, small lowercase letters, F and Y, sometimes you have one glyph that put the dot of the E inside the F. And that's coded inside the file, the font file. So in Arabic, they have a lot of ligatures. And lately, I've discovered that they also use color for accent. And Google Fonts has some new fonts with this characteristic, color fonts. Do you know color fonts?
No.
They're very, very new. They're coming.
How do you deploy color to what? You're going to have to explain that.
Well, they have color coded inside the typeface. It's a new format we can use. And it's linked to CSS. It's not so much ready, but it's coming. It's a new technology after variable fonts.
So certain aspects, certain portions of the letter receive different colors.
Yes.
And it provides, I have to just ask, why? Why would you want to have a different portion of the letter in a different color?
Apart from Arabic, why not?
Oh, so it is. It's just style. It's not from the point of view of readability or legibility.
No. New frontiers of typography.
Oh, that is interesting.
But that was one point. But for Arabic, might be for readability purpose. That's why I mentioned it.
Honestly, this is such a fascinating subject. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. Where would we go if we've been inspired by the talk that you've given today to me? Have you got any tips or places, websites to go to if people are curious? Where would you send them?
Okay, there are plenty of places, and typography has been receiving quite an attention lately on the web. I'm always talking about on the web. But you can start with books from the tradition of typography. There are, I don't know, from the Sacred Book of Typography, Robert Bringer's The Elements of Typographic Style. That's a really nice starting point. Well, it's not only a starting point. Eric Spiekelman's Stop Stealing Sheep and Find Out How Type Works. It's a very funny name. There's a history. I won't spoil it. Or I really, really like the book by Richard Rutter that is more on the web. It's called Web Typography. It's a manual on that. Or otherwise, you can follow Jason Pimentel that has been making a lot of experiments. It depends which part are you interested in.
You've given three or four things there. There's probably something to get your teeth into. And what about you? Where would we find you if people have listened to this and quite fancy having a chat with you about all this? Where do you hang out online?
Quite everywhere. Maybe on LinkedIn. Maybe you can reach me there, so it's better.
I will find your LinkedIn profile and I will link to that in the show notes. So let's wrap it up there. Julia, thank you so much for chatting to me today. Honestly, a real eye-opener. I've enjoyed that a lot.
Thank you. Me too.